All right, this is starting a little late because, as usual, I forgot to turn it on when I should have. Fortunately, there is no one dependent on this recording. There may be people who find it useful, including those in this room. All right, so anyway, the tort crime puzzle, why do we have two? Should we have two? But also the puzzle of, given that we have two, why are they different in the ways they are? Why do we require only preponderance of the evidence in tort law, but proof beyond a reasonable doubt in criminal law? Why do we require intent for criminal law, at least in theory, although not in practice? And why do we not require intent for tort law? I'll let you think about what are examples of crimes which, in fact, are committed without intent, but they're, I think, are examples, even though in theory they aren't supposed to be. And then the final sort of summary issue, we're going to go back to Posner's original conjecture and say, well, look, we've now looked at lots of the law and lots of the economic analysis. What was the project implicit in Posner's original work? It was look at every possible legal rule, figure out what it ought to be if it's economically efficient, and if it's a common law rule, see if that fits what it is. And we will then be discussing both from what we now know. Is it true? Is the common law generally efficient? And the related question, are there any reasons, or what are the reasons to think it would be? And other summary stuff at the end. So that's sort of a sketch of the rest of the course. Any questions? All right. Property. This time I'm just outlining the next, whatever, how long, 45 minutes or so. And that really consists of first the bundling question, which is really coming out of our Kosian work, which is I think I own a piece of land, but it isn't really true. What I actually own is a bundle of rights with regard to that piece of land. And indeed, in my particular case, the bundle does not include some of the really fundamental rights with regard to a small strip of that land. Any guess what that small strip is? The south half of Williams Road, the street I live on. I am guessing, though I don't know, the house is 100 years old, and my guess is the house is older than the road is. But I was at least told when I bought the house that my property line goes all the way into the middle of the street, but alas, the city of San Jose has an easement, so therefore I do not own the right to forbid you from trespassing on my property if you happen to be driving east on Williams Road, even though you will briefly cross my property. But the general issue is, in designing these bundles of rights that we call ownership of land or ownership of something else, ownership of this computer, what do we include in the bundle? What should we include? What's the efficient rule, as well as seeing what actually happens? All right. And the basic Kosian argument is they're really asking two questions. One is, to whom is this particular stick in the bundle worth most? We'd like things to be in the hands of those who value them most. But since we can't perfectly do it, how can we set up our property rules so that if I've got something that's worth more to you, it ends up with you, and the easement on my property would be an example of doing exactly that. The second question is one which I think people don't discuss enough, although it's really becoming more of a live issue now, thanks in part, I think, to Larry Lessig, who's a sort of high-profile public legal theorist I'm not sure where he is at the moment, but he was at Chicago when I knew him, and then he was at Harvard, and then he was at Stanford. And he does lots of interesting things, and he's pushed some ideas about treating certain things as commons instead of as property. But in fact, it's a very interesting general issue. Not everything in the world is private property. That many things are property. The question that naturally occurs to a non-economist is, why should anything be property? Why not just say, if you need something, use it? And the economists have adequate answers to that. And the question that naturally occurs to an economist is, why should anything not be property? What do I mean by a commons? By a commons, I mean something where anybody is permitted to use it. So that the air is, for most purposes, a commons. I don't need anybody's permission to breathe, to use the air. But there are lots of other commons around. Most of what you might think of as intellectual property isn't. Most potential intellectual properties are commons. For example, what's an obvious, enormous commons of what could be intellectual property?
English language?
Well, the English language, it would be hard to make intellectual property. That's the example of the book, of course. What I was thinking of was all out of copyright works. What?
Public domain.
That's right. That is, I happened to discover that a really good alternate history that I read recently and liked, which was deliberately sort of based on a bunch of old literature, sort of not take off because it wasn't mocking it, but playing with it, that the largest source was a book from a little less than 100 years ago I'd never read, called King of the Khyber Rifles by Talbot Mundy. And so what do? I go up on the internet, and sure enough, Project Gutenberg has got a downloadable version of King of the Khyber Rifles. It's currently in my cell phone, so I can read it at my leisure if I like, because it's out of copyright. All right? People know about Project Gutenberg, by the way? You should. If you like reading books, you should. Project Gutenberg is a project started a fair while ago by, I think, a Catholic college in Illinois originally, or somebody at one, to get volunteers to digitize and proof out of copyright literature and put it up on the web for free. And they've got a huge amount of stuff. I mean, it's surely in the tens of thousands of books, maybe 100,000 books by now, which means that anything famous, pretty nearly, which is out of copyright, you can download for free. Download The Wealth of Nations by Adam Smith. You can download Casanova's memoirs. You can download at least some of the Oz books. Lots and lots of old literature. Wonderful project. But anyway, but my point now is just that all of that stuff could be property. We could have copyright law that lasts forever. We don't. And there are lots of other things that are commons. So then the question is, what are the arguments for treating something as property versus treating something as a commons? And that involves thinking about the advantages of treating things as property, but also the disadvantages. What are the costs of treating something as property? In the basic property rule, we know it is something belongs to somebody, and if anybody else wants to have it or use it, he needs the permission of the owner. That's sort of the gut level. Oh, and the other rule is when new things come into existence, they are the property of the people who brought them into existence, except for babies. In thinking about the trade-off, it turns out that one fun thing to do is to look at primitive societies. Because primitive societies face rather different circumstances than we do, and it turns out some of them treat land as property and some as commons, and you can start thinking about, is it just that they're stupid or are there good reasons? I'll go into this in more length as well, of course, in a chapter dozen. Real property versus unreal property. It's unreal is my terminology, of course. By real property, I mean real estate, which is basically land and, I guess, buildings on the land. And one of the differences in the law is that real property, our legal system allows a whole lot of rebundling. For example, easements, licenses, and so forth. Whereas for ordinary property like computers, you can get some of the effects of rebundling by contract, but that's a much more limited method because a contract is only binding on the parties who signed the contract. And then all of this, I'm going to argue, is a lead into intellectual property because, in a sense, the first central question is, should the right to copy this book, should the use of this idea be a part of the commons, or should it be property belonging to somebody? So start out with bundling rights. And if you start thinking about this, you say, well, it's easy. I own my piece of land, so I should start out owning every right associated with that land. And the problem, the simplest problem with that, is that not all of the rights that I care about with regard to my land are unambiguously associated to my land, because after all, I can stand next to the property line beating a drum. I'm doing it on my land, but it has an effect on my neighbor's ability to go to sleep. When you transmit radio signals from a transmitter in San Francisco that are being received by somebody, in South San Jose, those radio waves may go through my property, through the air above my land. Does that mean that I own the right to enjoin them? In fact, it doesn't, of course, but that's associated with my land. So you can think of lots of cases where it is ambiguous whether or not the property right covers it. And another one, which I discussed briefly before, is if you are pumping oil on your land and the result is that some of the oil under my land is flowing into your part of the reservoir, who owns that set of rights? And of course, part of the answer which that case suggests is that if we were in a world of perfect information, we could say, well, it's really very easy. Every molecule of oil is going to get labeled. We're going to have a little tag on all the molecules asserted in my land, which say property of David Friedman, all the molecules under your land say your property, and so forth. Anybody can pump it up who wants it, but it's not his. So if he pumps up my oil, he's going to have my permission to sell it. Not doable, so we therefore come up with clumsier and less propertarian ways of doing it. So the Coasean answer is, the first question is, which sticks belong in the same bundle, to use that metaphor. So that if I own the right to grow grain on my land, I have to own, as a practical matter, the right to go on the land, because without that I can't cultivate the grain. If I'm growing grain on the land, what's the other right that would be really nice for me to own? What don't I want you to do? The right to keep other people out of that land, at least when there's grain in the field. Maybe I may or may not care about whether I keep people out in February, but at least when there's grain in the field, I want that right. And so you can think about constructing bundles on that basis. But we know that the legal system is never going to get it entirely right, that there are going to be cases where, indeed, land is being used for growing grain. If what you say is, I can only keep you out of off my land if I've got grain growing on it, that gives me an incentive to plant grain somewhere where I actually don't want to grow grain as a way of keeping people off my land. For example, if I really care about is peeping toms and the law doesn't let me prohibit them, I plant the borders of my land with a strip of grain 8 feet wide and say, now nobody can get close enough to peer in through my windows without trampling my grain, and that's trespassing. So, in fact, we have much broader rules than that, such as general rules prohibiting trespass. But we know they'll sometimes be wrong, that there are going to be cases where, for example, the layout of the land is such that in order for you to get from your house, for your kids to get from your house to school, they have the choice of walking a mile around my land or a quarter of a mile across my land. We want some way of letting them do the latter, assuming it doesn't do any harm. So we want to define our property rights in ways which make it as easy as possible to rearrange the bundle in ways that don't have high transaction costs. And all of this stuff is really implicit in what we've done already. We're just applying it. But an example of the transaction cost problem would be the issues of things like trespassing photons or radio waves. And this goes back to our farmers and railroads. If the legal rule is that initially I have the right to enjoin radio waves from trespassing on my land, but of course if you want to broadcast you can buy permission from me, there will be no radio broadcasts, because given the range of radio waves you'd need unanimous assent from a huge number of people. On the other hand, suppose the rule is simply that I can collect tort damages. I have a liability right that if your radio wave actually does damage to me, then I can sue you and collect. All right? That has some advantages, because to begin with, almost all the cases, the damages are zero and the problem doesn't arise. But you could imagine a case when you set up your transmitter next to my house and it turns out that the intensity of the radio waves there is so high that my computer won't work, and that various other things go wrong, and maybe I get cancer or something, we might want to have some legal rules to restrict that, to make sure that you put up your antenna in places where nobody lives close to it, if there are such effects. So there might be something to be said for a liability rule, or alternatively, the current basic rule we have, which is that I have no rights with regard to radio waves, although I expect under nuisance law, in the extreme enough case, I could do something about it. Trespassing photons, my standard argument is, if I really have an absolute property right, then I can forbid you from turning on your lights in your house if I can see your house from my property. Because if I can see your house, that means some of your photons are trespassing onto my property to get to my eyeballs, to my retina. So again, you want to define the rights to way you construct your bundle, just as with the railroad farmer example, in ways designed to make to make rebundling that might be necessary as easy as possible. think about the adjacency problems, which exist in various dimensions, and common law of nuisance deals with a good deal of it. I was sort of intrigued when I found out about Pennsylvania property law a good many years ago. And I think the courts have changed matters somewhat in recent decades, but I'm not really interested in that because I'm a theorist, not a lawyer, so I don't have to worry about what it is at the moment. But the traditional Pennsylvania system was really neat because the special feature of the state of Pennsylvania is that it's made out of coal. Enough of it is made out of coal, so if you remove all of the coal, very bad things will happen to the people who are living on top of the rock layers that have coal underneath them. And the result of that is that you have to think about the three separate property rights that belong in a bundle in Pennsylvania, but not in most other places, those being the surface estate, the mineral estate, and the support estate, the right to have your surface held up by what's underneath it. And if we were in an environment where what you were mining involved taking out 1% of the stuff under the land, we wouldn't worry about support rights. All right? There's no reason if you're following, you know, a vein of silver this long, well, you need a tunnel big enough to get your miners by, but you don't have to take out half a mile on either side. But when what's happening is coal mining, you do take out half a mile on either side sometime, and therefore you have the old system that you simply define three different estates in the same piece of land, and people can freely buy and sell. So if you are constructing a really nice house on the surface, it is prudent for you first to find out who owns the support estate. Mineral estate isn't that important, but it will probably belong to the same person if it doesn't belong to you. If the land you're buying comes to the support estate, you're home free, and if it doesn't, you would better simultaneously bargain to buy the support estate as well as the surface estate. The argument, point clear. The horizontal problem is an old problem that on the face of it, you're sort of your moral intuitions. You say, well, what right do I have to say what you're doing on your land? But if what you're doing on your land is digging a pit right next to the property line with my house on the other side of the property line, and so after a while, the dirt starts falling into your pit, and I call up to complain. You say, what are you complaining about? Your dirt is trespassing on my property. That's your problem. Why don't you hold it back? But in fact, under common law, it was recognized that the land I bought came with a right to horizontal support, meaning that if there were features of the land adjacent to it that kept it from sliding sideways, I've got a right to have those features remain. Okay. So that's sort of a nice case of the same thing. The common pool problems I discussed somewhat in an earlier class, but the basic logic of it is that we're sitting over a pool of oil. If we all act independently, we are going to drill too many holes and pump too fast. We'll drill too many holes because you have a hole on your property, but that gets you oil. I want a hole on my property so I can get some of the oil. And if I pump slowly, that means most of the oil will go up your well instead of mine. But pumping fast, in fact, is not only more costly, it gets us less oil given the actual mechanics of oil wells, because we're using up the gas pressure that's forcing the oil out. In that case, the rule in a number of states that have lots of oil in them is a unitization rule, which basically says that by a supermajority vote of all the landowners, the oil under the land is converted into joint property of all of them, with some set of decision rules, which I know very little about. Right? That obviously has some problems. That how do we decide exactly who gets a share in that? Where do we draw the lines of the pool? Is this two pools or one pool and so forth? And if it's, you know, a small pool and a big pool, I'm on the small pool. I want to have it defined as one pool, so I'll get a larger share. And there's the same problem you have with any corporate arrangement, which is whatever our decision rules are, how do we make sure that in practice the subset of the owners who end up in control of things, which might be a majority once the thing is established, don't use their control to siphon the benefits to them instead of to everybody. Those are all problems, but at least we've solved the initial problems. Any opinions on whether you like slides looking like this better or worse than slides with a white background? This happens to be left over from some experimentation I was doing with fancy slides on a previous time when I did the slides that these are modified from, but I was just curious as to whether people did or didn't like it.
It's not a white background?
It's not a white background. It's a pale blue background. Again, it's not as clear there here, but it is clear if you look at it.
Yeah.
I see white.
You see a white background.
Yeah, it really looks kind of like...
Now, is it clearer?
You know, it sort of looks like... It still would look white to me. It would look white, but sort of...
All right.
Not really white because I'm seeing.
Yeah. I've had the same issue when doing web pages. Some of my web pages have pale blue backgrounds, and some of them have white backgrounds, but I'm not sure which is better. All right. So now let's go to the property versus commons one, which I think is a really fun one. And I gave the example in the book of the English language. And my standard argument for turning the English language into private property is the lack of gender-neutral pronouns in English. That it is clear that the world would be a far better place if, when I was speaking of a person of indefinite gender, I did not have to choose between using he, which is the old answer but will offend some people, using he or she, which shouldn't offend anybody but is clumsy, or inventing some new form which nobody will understand. And we've had one example of this problem being solved already, and that's the innovation of the term Ms., M-S, which was a solution to the analogous problem of marital status indefinite. How do you, in the English language, refer to somebody when you don't know or don't want to specify whether the a female somebody, whether the person is married or not married? I should say the English language has the opposite problem with regard to men, of course, that there isn't a simple way of just defining men as married or unmarried, and I'm sure there are profound reasons for that difference, but they aren't ones I know much about. But in any case, so it would be nice if we had a set of gender-neutral pronouns. Obviously, gender-neutral pronouns would be worth a fortune. Just think of how many people would use them. So therefore, when I, after a extensive linguistic study, come up with the perfect set of gender-neutral pronouns, and I then spend $50 million popularizing them in all sorts of ways so everybody will know them and use them, and I then collect license fees for the next 50 or 100 or 200 years or something, I and my descendants, from everybody who uses my gender-neutral pronouns. So that's the argument in favor, whereas now nobody is going to engage in that effort, so they'll only come into existence if there's some nice, easy, intuitive way of doing it, as was for Ms. But the problem, of course, is that if we treat the English language as private property, then the transaction costs of writing and speaking become very high, because when you're writing or speaking, you're using... The English language, as I'm describing, it doesn't belong to one person. You could just, you know, take out a lifetime license from the owner. The English language would belong to a huge number of different people, the initial inventor of each word, or maybe each new grammatical structure, or things like that, or whoever he had transmitted it to. And I think it's clear that the costs of doing that would be enormously higher than the benefits, so it's sensible to treat it as a commons, which is what we do. So the advantage of property is that a property system gives you an incentive to produce things if their value is greater than their cost, my initial point. It also gives you an incentive not to overuse things, that even if you think about the English language, with a little effort you can probably think about expressions that were once striking and new and, you know, worked very well and have now gotten worn out to the point you hardly notice what it is. Trying to remember whose line it was that in some subculture or other, fuck is the equivalent of has entirely lost all content and emotive power as a result of being enormously overused. But even short of that, there are lots of things where... And if you think about the classic tragedy of the commons problem, which is in part fictional because it in part doesn't describe the real English commons, but it certainly can describe some things. But the standard story is you have a common field. Everybody in the village is allowed to pasture as many cows as he wants on that field. When I add one more cow to my herd, that results in there being less grass left in the commons for everybody else's cow, and we end up with the commons being overused, producing very little, and all of us are worse off. That's the classic tragedy of the commons. And property avoids that. And, of course, the issue, if we have a limited amount of something, if it's a commons, whoever comes by first and grabs it, whereas if it's property, then if I come by first and grab it, you buy it from me, if you value it more. But there is a disadvantage. And roughly speaking, the disadvantages of property are the cost of defining and enforcing property rights and the cost of transacting over them. And I then discussed in the book what I thought was an interesting example coming out of an old Economics Journal article about primitive societies, which points out that some of them treat land as private property, some don't, and some of them treat land as private property part of the year. And that last one, which really goes back to my point about wheat earlier, suggests that it isn't they don't understand the idea of private property, it's that it isn't always useful. And you can see that for agriculture, private property is a great idea, but if you're hunting large animals across the land, you don't really want to stop at every boundary marker to ask permission from the owner to cross his land while the animal rolls away. But you might want some other property rights for hunting. In hunting, you might want some kind of a hot pursuit rule. You might want to say, if I spot the deer, and we're a primitive society, and all I got is a spear or maybe a bow and arrow, so I've got to run the deer down to get close enough to kill it. Unfortunately, I get tired. Ha, but you clever person that you are, were sitting, resting, listening to the rustlings in the woods, and you heard me and the deer running through, so you pick up the chase as I get exhausted, you get the deer and kill it. That has some real problems, because nobody does the initial hunting because someone else is going to get the deer, so maybe we want a rule which says that in that case, I, the initial person, own the deer, or I own a half share in the deer, or something like that. So you can see that whether it does or doesn't make sense to define property in things and in what things depends a whole lot on the facts of the circumstances. The internet is in large part a commons, not entirely, but a whole lot of people use the internet to simply give information away to anybody who wants it, and that seems to work pretty well. Consider private commons. The nice thing about a private commons any public commons, an economist could always say, yes, but it's a mistake. We would be better off if we made it property. It's just this stupid legal system doesn't do it. But then we observe fresh choice, all-you-can-eat salad bars, all-you-can-eat spaghetti restaurants, say, wait a minute. Fresh choice is bearing all the costs of running that commons. They've got to provide the food in the restaurant. They're collecting the benefit of what they charge people to enter the restaurant. It must be that they find, for many years' experience at many restaurants, that the net benefits of treating food as a commons, at least for the particular kind of restaurant they're running, is higher than the net cost, or they wouldn't be doing it. So that's sort of a nice example where you get a commons inside a legal system of private property. They're allowed to charge for their food. Most of the other restaurants do. Strongly suggesting that at least in some cases the commons is actually a more efficient solution than private property, not less efficient, which is why they do it. Is that point clear? Both in the sense in which it's a commons, they charge for entry, but they don't charge once you're inside it, and in the sense in which its survival in a competitive market is evidence for the efficiency in some circumstances of the commons as a way of allocating resources. Think about the radio spectrum. It occurred to me when I was planning for class today that it actually provides a very interesting range of alternatives. Because it, at the very beginning, I think at the very beginning of radio, I think it was actually treated as private property under homesteading rules. I think the original rule was that if a station had been broadcasting at some frequency in some area, that then it had a right to prevent other people from doing that, though I'm not sure that's right. But fairly early, the government came in with the FCC, and for a long time, the radio waves were simply treated as government property. That is to say, if you wanted a radio station, you had to get a license from the FCC. The license did not mean they had sold you the right to use those frequencies, because you couldn't simply say, I'm only using half this area. My license covers Dallas and Houston. What I'm going to do is to broadcast in Houston, cut down my power, and sell somebody else the right to broadcast on that frequency in Dallas. No legal way of doing that. What was the way in which you could, if you wanted, de facto transfer ownership of the right to broadcast at certain frequencies? The only way, as far as I know, in the old system. Anybody know? I got to sell the station.
Yeah.
The station comes with its license. The licenses were valuable. I gather that LBJ's personal fortune was based on radio licenses at a time when he was a very powerful politician in Congress. But furthermore, it wasn't really a property right because the government got to decide how you used it. That in theory and very occasionally in practice, they could say, we don't think your broadcasts are in the public interest, we're therefore going to lift your license. Not a violation of freedom of speech as far as the law was concerned, because after all, it's not a license, not a violation of freedom of speech if I refuse to sell you paper for your book. So why is it if the government who owns the airwaves refuses to license, to let you use the airwaves for a particular purpose? And then this madman named Ronald Coase, somewhere around 1960 or so, wrote an article on the subject of the radio spectrum, in which he made this obviously either crazy or at least wildly utopian proposal that they auction it off. He says, look, why don't we treat it as private property just like lots of other things? The government can auction the right to broadcast on some frequency in some area, and people can then subdivide it, combine it, sell it, rent it, do all the normal stuff. And my impression is that nobody but a few economists took him seriously for quite a long time, and eventually the FCC was persuaded and did it. Not in as complete a version, I think, as Coase or I would like, but at this point, as you probably know, from time to time they announce an auction of some chunk of frequencies, and they get a lot of money for it. What's one of the obvious advantages of a straight auction system? As opposed to, in the old system, the government says, all right, these frequencies are for radio transmittal, these frequencies are for television, these frequencies are for some other purpose, and we'll license you to do it. And that's not only whichever person, but whichever use.
Right.
Think about cell phones versus radios. It's not obvious how much of the frequency should go to which. Market can determine it. All right? But also, parts of the radio frequency are commons. What part of the radio frequency is a commons, which it would not be astonishing if one of the four of you was using at this very moment, and which I expect all of us have used within the last 24 hours?
Wi-Fi.
Wi-Fi, precisely. Wi-Fi was the case I was thinking of. Wi-Fi is a commons. The rules, I think, limit the strength of the signals. I don't know the exact rules, but within those limits, I don't need to get any special individual permission to either send or receive Wi-Fi. My wireless router in my house presumably had to be approved that it was within the limitations, but it doesn't require its own separate license. And there's the occasional inconvenience that occasionally my son can't receive Wi-Fi in the house, and I suspect the reason is that someone else in the neighborhood is using the same channel, and so I go up and switch the channel on my Wi-Fi router, which is inconvenient because it essentially cuts off the internet communication for 30 seconds, which is a pain if my wife is playing World of Warcraft at the moment, so I got to check with her first that it's safe. But
there's only really two channels.
What?
There's only really two channels. Every other channel,
yes,
and 1 and 11 is a mix of the
two. Huh, that's interesting. So there are only two frequencies? I didn't know that.
Basically.
So if I observe interference on 2, am I better off going to 11 rather than to a random one?
Presumably.
Yeah. I don't know. All I know is that the method I described normally works. So I have this conjecture of what's going on. But I assume that one could, with a little effort, find out what channels other people were broadcasting on, but I haven't. But in any case, so at the moment you've really got a mix. And, of course, the current system of auctions is not a full-scale auction because they generally auction for a specific purpose. And not everything's auctioned, but it's moved in that direction. And a current, more or less live issue, or at least a live issue in recent years, is proposals to shift from a property model, not to the government model, but to a commons model, to the Wi-Fi model. And the argument, which maybe some of you know more of the technology than I do, is the claim that with current radio and television technology, you don't need dedicated channels. The claim is that what's called spread spectrum, in which, if I understand correctly, you've got a smart receiver and a transmitter which can shift the frequency it's working on when it observes interference, a receiver that has some way of knowing that and can shift what it's receiving. And so the claim is, that's one of the points, if you just scan across the radio dial, even in a fairly densely populated area, you notice a lot of silence. And that suggests that the present property system isn't getting a very full allocation. It suggests that there's lots of unused spectrum. Well, unused spectrum suggests to an economist maybe the real cost of using spectrum is close to zero. That suggests maybe a commons is a sensible arrangement. And so Larry has at least argued, not an argument that I know enough to know if it's right, and I'm not even sure if he knows enough to know if it's right, given by his failure to answer some of the obvious questions when I put them to him. But it is an argument people make, and it might be right, that we would be better off if we simply abolished the existing system and said anybody with some maybe upper limit on frequency, anybody can broadcast anything, any frequency he likes, and let people find technological ways of working in that system. Suppose they're right. Suppose we have an auctioning system which is basically ours, except that I'm going to have an auctioning system which when they auction a band of frequencies, they don't specify the use. If it's true that a commons is a much more efficient use than property, what do you think would happen in that system? What ought to happen?
Different competitors that want for their particular technology are going to band together to try and purchase it for that technology.
You would essentially expect a radio version of Fresh Choice.
Right.
What you would expect would be a buyer or buyers who buy a band of spectrum, announce that it's a commons, but with some restriction that in effect lets them control entry to the commons. So they say anybody can use it, provided his receiving device is licensed under our patent XXX and X, and we will make our revenue from charging $1 for every radio licensed under that patent. And the use of the radio waves themselves will be free. And at the time when I made, I should say, I was at a conference that Larry and other people ran on this subject, and both I and Harold Demsetz, who's a generation earlier economist than I am, who's Harold likes to say that he really should have gotten Ronald Coase's Nobel Prize, because while it's true that Ronald Coase made Coase's arguments first, Harold has made Coase's arguments many more times than Ronald has. He's actually a fairly important economist, sort of early on developing off some of these ideas. He and I both made exactly this argument that if Larry was right, then you didn't need to make it all a commons, you could just let somebody make part of it a commons. And Larry's claim was that spread spectrum works more efficiently the wider the band, and therefore it would work only with the whole thing. When I asked him, well, how much more efficiently? If you double the size of band, does that, you know, reduce your costs by 10% or 90%? He had no idea. That was the point at which I concluded he didn't know if his proposal was a good idea either. But it could be. It could be that you really need very wide bands. I gather, however, that Google made an effort, though I'm not sure if it finally succeeded or not, to bid on a chunk of spectrum with, I think, something along these lines as their objective. What?
It did not succeed.
Did not succeed. And I think partly Google was trying to rig the bid, in that I think Google was at least trying to get the FCC to limit what the spectrum could be used for so as to cut down the competing bids. And I did not, and maybe you followed it in more detail than I did.
I don't know as much about that. It relates to the digital television transition, too.
Uh-huh.
That's why they're switching from analog to digital, so that they can take that frequency.
Yeah.
And they've already auctioned it off.
Yeah. Go. And of course you can see that one other virtue of Coase's proposal, I don't know if it occurred to him, is that it puts pressure on the government to move towards efficiency. Because if the government is defining uses, how it defines it will affect how much money it can get in those auctions. And it's really nice to have an extra couple of billion dollars dumped into the budget without having to collect any taxes. And sums are significant. So in any case, but that's another interesting example of that whole issue. So what are the problems with property? One property is defining what you own. And I've got this story in the chapter, which I thought was sort of neat when I came across it, about Stack Island, the island that floated down the Mississippi River. All right, which can't be literally true because islands don't do that. But what happened was it was eroding on the upstream end, depositing on the downstream end. And there happened to be a set of existing property rules such that one person owns Stack Island and another person owned all islands in a certain stretch of the Mississippi, as a result of owning the land on one bank of Mississippi. and Staten Island drifts into that band of the Mississippi. And now the question is, who owns it? And the court wimped out by using a adverse possession grounds for settling the case, if there are any people actually been dealing with the island. But in principle, there isn't an answer, because in principle, you have a, they have set up, in perfect innocence, what looks like an unambiguous definition of property rights that turns out to be ambiguous. And of course, that ambiguity also raises sort of a different point, which is, what do you mean by Staten Island anyway? Do you mean particular pieces of dirt? Sorry, buddy, none of the dirt that was in Staten Island 100 years ago is in Staten Island anymore. Right? All of that dirt is somewhere out in the Mississippi Delta, because it eroded away and floated down the Mississippi as mud and got dumped at the mouth of the Delta. And all of the dirt, let me suppose, I don't know it's true, but let's assume it's true, that is now Staten Island is actually from somewhere up in Illinois or Iowa or something that was washed out of the banks and eventually deposited on the upstream. So we have this intuitive idea of an island as a fixed object. And yet, you know, it's somebody's line that you can never step in the same stream twice. And in most cases it is. I mean, if you take an ordinary island, I expect the dirt underneath this building is the same dirt that was there 300 years ago, probably, unless they've done some major bulldozing and stuff. But in this particular case, it wasn't. So that's sort of neat. I mean, it sort of points out a problem. And then I came across this story, I think I quote in the chapter, about land rights on the banks of the Nile, I think in the Sudan, which is another really neat story, because they do it right. Right? They say, look, all we're using this land for is planting crops. I'm going to assume, but I think is the case, that there... I'm going to assume what I think is the case, that there weren't any important structures. So here is the river. Here is my piece of property. Here is your piece of property. And if we follow the normal kind of rules, sort of, that anybody who didn't live on the Nile would think of with the natural rules, we would say that when next year the river is running here, tough luck, a bunch of your property is underwater, but I'm doing pretty well. I don't have to carry water as far to irrigate my crops. Not a very sensible arrangement. If you know this is going to happen routinely, the river ships back and forth every year. So what they do instead, which sounds like a much more sensible arrangement, is to say, no, I didn't own this chunk of land. What I owned was a chunk of land whose position was defined relative to the bank of the Nile. So when the river moved, the property moved too. Wouldn't work so well if you had permanent structures, obviously, but it works pretty well if you're just using the land for growing crops on. And so all of those sort of raise the point that simply defining what you own in some cases turns out to be quite tricky and you have to worry about it. And maybe the biggest one of those is patent law. Because if any of you have taken patent courses, you know that there really is no clear definition of what a patent covers. That you've got the patent application and the patent says, you know, all ways of doing X, Y, and Z, or this way of doing X, Y, and Z, and so forth. The patent is not of the particular machine. That's merely a single demonstration. The patent is not of the way of applying the idea that you describe in the patent. It's not the reduction to practice. The patent is the idea, and ideas have fuzzy boundaries. One of the things I like to discuss in this context was, I assume you're all aware of Samuel Morse's attempt to patent the Internet. You didn't know that Samuel Morse tried to patent the Internet? Fifth claim in the patent for the telegraph, I think it was the fifth claim, was all ways of using the electromagnetic power to transmit letters and symbols to a distance. Covers the Internet. He didn't get it, I should say. But yes, it would have. But in any case, and of course, it was refused as overbroad, but of course it should have been refused as not novel, because at this very instant, you reading that screen are using the electromagnetic force, since light is also electromagnetic, to transmit and so forth. But anyway. Then there's the cost of enforcing rights, that if the particular right is one where it's very costly to monitor to see if people are violating the right, it doesn't make much sense to enforce a right, to define a right you can't enforce. And there I've got my story in the chapter that I'm still very fond of why we owe civilization to the dogs. The idea, basically, that in a primitive society, at least I imagine, I don't know if it's true or not, but it's, I think, a plausible story, private property in agricultural land, great idea though it was, wasn't workable because it was too costly to keep your neighbors from sneaking over at night and planting and stealing your crops. Now you domesticate the dog, the bionic burglar alarm, dogs are territorial, you teach your dog what the boundaries of your property are, he barks if anybody comes on it, and you can sleep at night. So, if that's right, without dogs, common property was the right rule, even though it's not a very good rule, whereas with dogs, private property was the right rule. And you can imagine other technological changes having similar effects. And then there's finally the problem of creating rights. And creating rights is a desirable feature when the rights are in things which exist due to human action. So that the fact that when I write a book, I end up owning the copyright is a feature of copyright law because it gives me a reason to write books. But if you have property that already exists, such as land, now somehow in order to handle it by property, you've got to allocate the rights to it. But then it gives people an incentive to engage in rent-seeking activity, that is to spend resources making sure that that existing value goes to them instead of somebody else. And that's the Terry Anderson, P.J. Hill classic article on homesteading, in which they argue, in effect, that the result of the Homesteading Act, which everybody in American history thinks of as this wonderful thing, was to wipe out the land value of the United States. I exaggerate only slightly. And the argument basically is that the way you get ownership of land is to settle it and farm it for a certain length of time and grow a tree on it, do various things, before anyone else does it. That once the land is valuable, it pays you to start doing those things. Not when doing those things becomes worth doing, not when you can make more money from the crops you grow than it costs to grow them, but when the benefit of acquiring ownership of the land, which will be valuable in the future, covers the costs. And the result is that if you have a piece of land whose value is $10,000 and I say, well, look, I'm going to wait until it's worth farming that land to start farming it, then when I come out, when it's worth farming land, I see somebody else is already there. And why is he already there? Because he realized that if he farmed it for a couple of years early, he'd lose $1,000 on the farming, end up with a $10,000 piece of land. That's a good deal. But he couldn't get away with that either because someone else comes before that. Run through the argument and you see that, in effect, they will be rent-seeking up to the full value of the land. So people will farm just enough early so that what they pay in inefficient farming is equal to the value of the land they get. That's the P.J. Hill Terry Anderson argument. It's a neat argument, and in a sense suggests that homesteading simply wiped out this enormous resource of the value of land in wasteful farming. There was an article, I don't know if it was published or not, but I refereed it at one point, which was a response to that. Suppose you wanted to argue that homesteading law was a good idea, having read the P.J. Hill Terry Anderson piece and seeing the logic of it, what might you argue? How would you change it from a mistake to a brilliant? Anybody? The effect of homesteading law is that the frontier gets settled prematurely. All right? Prematurely is defined by whom? Prematurely as defined by the private interest of the private settler. So if you want to argue this is a good thing, what do you have to argue?
That they're going to use it best?
What?
That they would use it best?
Well, they could have used it best if you'd auctioned the land off too. Just later. Land would have remained empty until it was actually worth farming.
Greater value,
greater value to whom? If it's a greater value to the settler, he'll do it if you auction it.
Value to society
somehow. Or to all the other settlers. So the argument you have to make is that there's a positive externality to settling, that when I settle, that helps drive away the Indians or make sure that America gets it instead of Canada gets it if it's up in the Northwest. And somebody did write an article trying to argue that this was a device for pushing settlement faster than private action would have given it.
What about just like if you're settled already, then it's easier for me to settle because I have someone to trade goods with.
You could make that argument, but also someone to help me fight the Indians.
Right.
If they come in. You know, lots of, but that was the form of the argument you make, sort of a neat argument. But there's a different answer, and one which I recognized when I actually found a big book somebody had written on the history of the public lands. Because it turns out that Terry Anderson and P.J. Hill are not the first people to think of auctioning off the land instead of homesteading it. That was, in fact, the original system. That in the very early years, I think maybe even before the country when it was the colonies doing it, but the states doing it and then the federal government, there were sizable periods during which the public lands were auctioned off, and it didn't work. And basically, the reason it didn't work was that it is hard to auction off an inhomogeneous resource belonging to a political organization. Because what happens is they announce a certain chunk of land is now open for homesteading, which is just beyond the frontier, and you're the real estate the agent of a group of real estate investors in Boston who want to buy some land, and you go out to the far west in Ohio or something, and what do you find? You find there are people living on the land already. And you say, well, I mean, I don't really mind if they were using the land before, but of course they don't own the land, and, you know, I'm going to go to the auction, which they're having in a log cabin, which, the local government agent has set up, and there in the log cabin there are these rough, tough frontiersmen, and they've got rifles leaning up against the wall and tomahawks in their belts, and they explain to me very politely and gently that we don't know how it is back east, but around here, a man doesn't bid against a settler for his land. And it turns out that what's really happened is that a de jure system of auction has turned into a de facto system of homesteading, and so the homesteaders get their land without any other bidder at the lowest price that the auction permits. Or the homesteaders go to Congress and say, we're brave frontiersmen, auction the next chunk of land, but just give us ours. And so it worked rather poorly. So anyways, an interesting story. So the flip side of property is how big are the benefits? Well, one benefit is an incentive to produce stuff. One could argue that the reason people write novels is not to make a living, but because they really want to tell a story and have other people read it. And that becomes more plausible if you interact with a lot of would-be novelists and discover that the realistic ones realize, A, they will probably never get published, and B, if they do get published, it is quite unlikely they'll ever make a living at it. That basically, there are only two ways, as far as I know, of making a living by being a novelist. One of them is to be a real success, which is, you know, 1 in 1,000 or something. And the other is to write 3 novels a year, probably under 3 different titles, for some mass market like romances or westerns or something. And people write novels anyway. So maybe you might argue the elasticity of supply in economist terms is low. If you can't get paid by copyright, most of the novels will still get written. Therefore, there isn't much cost to treating books as comics. You don't know. Similarly, how big is the gain from efficient allocation? For intellectual property, the efficient allocation is to everybody because my reading a book doesn't stop you from reading a book. So there, the argument for property is weak. On the other hand, for computers, you're using my computer. It does stop me from using it. And not only that, you're using my computer means you get to read my email, which contains secrets I don't want you to know. So therefore, there are strong reasons for computers to treat them as property, to allocate them to the right person. Ditto for grain and so forth. And the incentive not to overconsume. I think typically all-you-can-eat salad bars are more common than all-you-can-eat sushi places, although I think I've observed at least one of the latter. And the reason is that the inefficiency from eating a serving of salad that's worth 10 cents to you and costs 15... that's worth 10 cents to you and costs 15 cents to produce, which you eat it because it costs you zero at a salad bar for that serving, is only a 5-cent inefficiency. Whereas the inefficiency of eating another sushi, which costs them $1 to produce and is worth 5 cents to you, is 95 cents. So that in general, the efficiency losses from overconsumption are low if production cost, if marginal cost is low, become high if it's high. So all of those things are going to affect the trade-off. We're running out of time. Internet is a commons, I will mention and pass on. Arguments for and against it, I will probably go back and do some of this stuff after the... I don't remember how much of the details of this I have in the chapter. I'll go look. But we're running out of time, so yes.
I like the white better.
You like the white better. All right.
I just noticed the last two slides, and the contrast is better, which makes it more visible.
All right. Fine. All right, well, this there. I didn't quite manage to cover everything I planned to cover, but we can do some of that a week from Tuesday, and I hope you will all enjoy your vacation. And with luck, I will no longer have a cold when we come back.